Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Great to have you company for another episode of the show. Now, if you're a practice owner who's always wondered, how do I build a business so that I can create time freedom in my life? How do I create the money and the time rather than having either money or time? Then this is an episode you're going to really love. Today, I'm speaking to Dr. Michael Filosi from Fullerton Park Dental in Adelaide. And Michael's been on quite the journey over the last 8 or 9 years. He bought a 2-chair practice. He's scaled that up to be an 8-chair practice, soon to be a 10-chair practice. And in so doing, he's reduced his clinical hours down to 0. And what that has given him is immense freedom. And in this podcast, we're going to talk about that journey, some of the things he's learned along the way, and the lessons that are going to be applicable to you if that's the journey you want to go on as well. Now, even if you don't want to go to 0 clinical days, maybe you want to go, well, I'm really happy doing some clinical time, but I want to have a bit more time freedom to spend, you know, with my family and friends and so on, then you're going to get loads and loads of gold out of this as well. So many pearls of wisdom, so much real world experience about scaling a dental practice. And you know, I've had the pleasure of watching Michael on this journey now for some time, and he is a really smart guy. And I know that he's going to share some tools, some tips, some strategies, and some really deep thinking about his journey and what's going to be applicable to you. Now, if you like this episode, then I'm going to encourage you to please let me know, because I spoke to Michael about this and we could have spoken for days on this stuff. Again, I've known Michael forever. And we are thinking that if there's value in this for you, we'll record another couple episodes and dive into some of the specifics in a bit more depth. So if you like this episode, please either email us at SavvyDentist, you know, hello@SavvyDentist.com. That would be terrific. Or go to Apple and please rate and review the podcast. That's how we get known. But please let us know, because we want to bring you content that is really valuable and helpful for you in your own practice journey. So I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed talking to Michael. And without any further ado, here's Dr. Michael Filosi. Hey, Michael, thanks so much for taking the time to come and join us on the podcast. It's wonderful to have you here, my friend.
Really happy to be here, Jesse. I've been looking forward to this. So, yeah, excited.
Me too, mate. Me too. Now, mate, you run a terrific practice in Adelaide, Fullerton Park Dental. And I'm wondering, for the sake of our listeners, could you just tell us a little bit about your practice as it is now, you know, the number of chairs, where you're located, what you do, all that sort of stuff?
Sure. So we are in Adelaide, suburban Adelaide in Fullerton, and we're currently an 8-chair practice, and we have hygienists, oral health therapists and dentists. We talk about the fact that we say we specialize in general dentistry, so small s, specialized, not big s, in the sense that we have proof of concept of what we do. We're a very, very busy practice, right the way through, families, young and old. And the place has got a fair bit of energy. It's not a practice which we sort of sit around not doing much. It's constantly thriving and humming. And yeah, that's the way we like it. We've got OPG, microscope, nitrous, all the gadgets, I suppose, as well. So yeah, really fortunate to work with some great people and great clinicians.
Now, mate, you've been on a bit of a journey over the last couple of years with your practice, and you've done very, very well. I know that you're currently reducing your clinical days. And again, just for the sake of the audience, what's your clinical load these days?
Near enough to 0.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is a really good and interesting case study about building a business that is a business. It's about, you know, the things that you enjoy doing are what's your three words? Hard, interesting, and
meaningful.
Meaningful, right? And so you find you get that level of intellectual stimulation from running the business, I know, because we've had lots of conversations.
Yeah.
But what I'd like to do is just step back in time a little bit, because I'm sure the practice hasn't, you know, always been the way it is now. How long have you had the practice? What did it look like when you got involved?
So I've been here, I think it's coming up to 9 years. So I was an employee dentist, like probably a lot of listeners, for a while. And I was actually really scared, and I wasn't sure whether practice ownership was for me or not. And I went off and did some business study, and I had this idea in my head that, oh, once I learn about business, then I'll know everything and I'll be right to own a practice. And we all know it doesn't work like that. And I remember I was working about 5 stories up on North Terrace in Adelaide, and I saw these skateboarders, these kids doing skateboarding. and they're trying to do these tricks, and more often than not, they'd fail. They stuffed up the trick. And I was watching that, and something, the penny dropped in my head to go, in order to succeed, you have to fail several times. So I thought about anyone who's exceptional at skateboarding, they can watch all the YouTube videos, read all the books, but at some point they've got to put both feet on the thing and then give it a crack. And I realized in that moment that I had to do the same. So I met up with a friend of mine and who just started up a practice actually. And I sort of mentioned to him, we're having coffee, and I said, oh, look, do you know any that might be for sale? And he mentioned one. He said, oh, look, there's one on Fullerton Road. It needs a bit of work, but I'm pretty sure that they are looking for someone to join. So I literally finished the coffee I was having, drove straight there, knocked on the front door, said, hi, my name's Michael. And the rest is history, as they say. So it was a very, you know, I'm a believer that fortune turns on small moments. And that was one of those moments that very, very much changed the whole trajectory of my life, very much for the better, and gave me that, as you say, Jesse, you know, hard, interesting, meaningful are the three things that I look for in life, to do things that tick all three of those boxes. So hard, it's got to be a level of challenge. We might go to meaningful, a sense of purpose. And the interesting one, interesting just means it lights a fire in my belly, I guess, or there's a curiosity to it, to going, do you know what? I want to know a bit more about that. So for us, as we grow, and I want to come back to what it was when I got here, but for us, we want to be a bigger practice with a small practice feel.
Yeah.
And that's a real challenge to do, because as things grow and scale, there's the possibility of you lose that sense of personality and personal touch to the practice and to any business.
Yeah, and that's the real risk, isn't it? Because the things 100%. That help you become successful, sometimes, yeah, you lose along the way. And I think that's a really good lesson there. So let's talk about when you knocked on the door, who opened the door and how did that conversation go? Because that takes a bit of, well, let's say a few kahunas to kind of knock on the door and ask the question.
Yeah, look, I've always, there's the thing, you know, don't die with the music in you. There's I want to have a crack at life, and I think that I'm lucky that I have, you know, we've all got talents, I guess, and things we're good at, but that's not enough. I want to give it a crack and really know that I've given anything that interests me every possible chance of success and really know what I can get out of it there. Mm. So I knocked on the door, turned to my right, and it was a one desk, front desk then, and small waiting room. And the place, look, I loved it. Fell in love straight away. It was like, yep, this is it. But it's fair to say it was pretty run down. And I don't mean that I bought the thing, so I'm not trying to put shade on it, right? But it needed some work. And I think everyone knew that it needed some work and needed a bit of young energy to come into it. So, it had cracks in the walls and had no computers, no answering machines, nothing. So it was a very much a blank canvas, no practice management software. It had paper case notes and everything else there. But for me, I love that. So that's what I started with. It was a two-chair practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was had some interesting setups, I suppose you could say, in terms of how things were all set up there that needed a bit of updating. But as soon as I walked in, I remember thinking, this is it, you found it. And it's been a lot of fun since.
So when you bought the practice, did you take it over holeless bowlers? Did you end up in a partnership? How did that look out?
So there were two negotiations that had to take part. So there were two partners. One of them owned the building, the property, and the other one was a half, and he was also half partner in the practice and had sold out to the other existing partner. So basically, one person owned the property, who was a retired dentist who used to work there. The other one owned the practice. So I bought in a half share of the practice initially, which worked out really well. The gentleman who I bought in with is a lovely, lovely man, and it's fair to say, he just wanted to come in, do his dental work and was happy. Whereas he wanted the improvements. He's enjoyed that, which is great, but he's a little bit closer to the end than the start of his career. So I've been really fortunate to work with him. I've been very grateful that he's been on board for what I've been wanting to do, and that's to his enormous credit. And I'm really proud that he gets to work in a really nice practice, the practice that he's likely always sort of something approximating what he'd want to work in but wasn't able to because the other gentleman owned the property, basically. So, yeah, I had to negotiate to buy the property initially with one gentleman, and then to buy half the practice with a view to then owning the whole thing, which is what it is now. So, yeah, I own the whole practice. and the property,
yeah,
which is great.
So let's just talk about the property. Because, again, I think that's a really useful exercise to explore for a minute before we get onto the stages of business growth. Mm-hmm. How pivotal and how important was that to you at the outset to have the opportunity to own the practice? Was that always in the front of your mind when you went?
Very much so. So for me, I'd worked in a practice that the lease wasn't renewed because a larger tenant was taking it over. And I saw the stress that caused, the owner of the practice having to relocate. Dental practices aren't easy to relocate. No. So for me, I very much wanted to be master of my domain. I wanted to own the property. So that was fundamental to what I was doing. So that was the first. I didn't want to buy into the practice until I knew I owned the property.
Yep.
So I bought the property. That gave security of tenure there, and then bought into the practice. I don't want to jump ahead, but we since bought next door as well, which is we've grown and extended and needed to expand our physical space. We purchased the property next door, demolished that, turned that into a car park, and then we're able to extend fully to the back of the original property. But to answer your question, Jesse, yeah, owning the property was pivotal in my head to my goals and aspirations and what I was trying to achieve.
Yeah, so what I'm picking up here, Michael, is you had a pretty clear picture of what you were looking to achieve at the outset. This was not a random knock on the door and I just let it all go. That obviously, even though, you know, to go back to your skateboarding metaphor,
Sure. Perhaps
at that point you hadn't put the 2 feet on the skateboard, but all that pre-work and that pre-thinking gave you some clarity about the outcomes you were trying to achieve, and you went into that negotiation clear-eyed about what 100%. Success looked like for you. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say I had a pretty clear vision of what I was wanting to do. I had a really clear vision. The thing is, working for someone, you're always sort of at the behest of how they want to run the practice. And I get that. I get that. I've done that. I respect that enormously because it's their business and their practice, no dramas. For me, I wanted to see, I had a view and a vision for how it could and should be done. And I wanted to live and die by my own sword. I wanted to go, do you know what? I want to see if this is going to work. I think it will. I think it will resonate with the world and the community. And this is my view of how a general dental practice should and could run. And I'd seen some dental practices that were very good business people, but poor clinicians. I'd seen some that were very good clinicians and poor business people, and I was determined to find that sweet spot in the middle where I could run a really good business and but also sleep well at night knowing I'm doing the right thing by patients and staff alike. So yeah, I was very clear and driven on what I wanted to achieve. And I think risk is an interesting thing. I think I wasn't the first person to look at the practice. In fact, quite a few others had turned their noses up at it, I suppose, because it had a lot of things that weren't, you couldn't just jump in and make it work. Yeah. But for me, I think that in hindsight, I think that I was able to de-risk it because I think I did have skills that made it not as risky for me as what it was for others. So I guess it's a bit like a trapeze artist. I look up and I go, heck, that looks scary. Mm. It looks really risky. But for them, they've trained for it. They've done it. They've done it all the time. They've practiced. So for them, it's a piece of cake. I think for me, it wasn't a piece of cake, to be clear, but I think I had the skills, experience, knowledge, desire, willpower, vision that what looked very off-putting to some people, to me, I saw enormous potential and I was in myself quite confident that I could make it work.
Mate, well, make it work you did and then some. So firstly, let's acknowledge that. But I want to just talk about those early days. What did you do in those early days? Because as you said, it was old, needed love, needed attention, no computerization, any of those sorts of things. What were the first steps you took in that journey to bring it up to date?
Sure. I worked hard. So I hustled. I did everything. So, you know, I was very fortunate to have some key people who, when I joined, they were on board for what I was trying to do. So to be really clear, that was an enormous help. But if I wasn't seeing patients, I was out the front trying to pull trees out of the ground. Yeah. I was knocking down door frames. I was out the back. I was in the ceiling picking out the macadamia nuts from the possums that had deposited them up there. And you name it, I did it. So I did whatever was necessary to do that. And I had no shame or pride in terms of what I was willing and able to do. So I was very happy to do whatever it needed to do. I made a vow to myself. I remember when I first walked through, I sat in my car and I made a vow to myself. And it was kind of quite naive at the time, but I said, if I have to drag this thing to where I want it to be, I'm doing it. And I meant it. And the thing is, right, I say it's naive because now the thing that I get the most joy from is when I walk down the hallway and I see a large contingent of people who work here who are all on board for the vision and they're all engaged with it. So the thing that actually brought me the most joy is not having to twist people's arms to buy into the vision that I have. So I say I'm like Vegemite. I'm a very strong taste and not everyone likes Vegemite and that's okay. And I've learned to accept that, right? But the thing with Vegemite is that when they try and market, Vegemite doesn't try and convince people who don't like Vegemite to eat it. Vegemite markets to the people who do like Vegemite, trying to get them to use it more. So for me, I get that I'm not everyone's cup of tea and that's okay. You know, it was ever thus in my life. But what I realized was there was a significant enough contingent of people who go, Michael, I get it. I'm on board. I want to be part of that. And I'm enormously grateful and thankful and still am to those people who are inclined that way. I am very, very fortunate to work with people that I can collaborate freely with, that there's not an arm twisting involved either way, where we can just kind of, we both agree on where we're at, where we're both trying to get to, and then we can both move together and work forward from there. So look, it wasn't without a few hiccups along the way, but yeah, I think I was very clear in the path forward and then fortunately was able to surround myself with people who believed in me, believed in that vision and wanted to be a part of it. And that's now what gives me, it's interesting reflecting on that commitment to myself in my car that time, because now I think, yeah, it was a little bit naive in the sense of thinking at that time, oh, look, it's all on me. I can do it all myself. Because the joy that I have now is going, wow, these people come to work willingly, happily, and are contributing in a really engaged and showing that discretionary effort that they're wanting to be part of what we're doing. And it's just a really cool feeling.
There's a couple of interesting sayings that have come to mind as you were sharing that. The first one is, if you want to go fast, go solo. If you want to go far, go with others, right? And the second expression that comes to mind, and by the way, neither of these are my own expressions, but the second one is, are you doing your best or are you doing what it takes? Mm-hmm. And I think there's an interesting distinction in there. And, you know, when I hear about you cleaning the macadamia nuts out of the ceiling space or knocking out door frames or whatever, mate, I did a lot of that stuff too. And I think that I just want to touch on this for a second because I think for some people listening to this podcast, they're expecting it to be easy because it looks easy on Instagram, or I'm happening to follow some influencer on social media who is showing the highlight reel of their life or whatever it is, right?
100%.
So can we just have a little talk about the value of hard work in this for a second, because I don't want to gloss over this, because I think what you've raised is a really incredibly important point, and sometimes business is hard. Mm-hmm. So can you just share your thoughts about that?
I got to be honest. So I like a lot of people listening to this podcast, right? I was very lucky at school to do well. And it wasn't because, you know, it's just that, you know, you win the genetic lotto, right? You're wired a certain way that the stuff at school comes easy. And I honestly thought, again, very naive, I thought, sweet, I'm set up for life here, happy days, the world is my oyster. And then you join the real world and workforce and you have the CRAP kicked out of you. And it was very humbling to go, heck, wow, was I wrong? And then you realize that, to me, hard work is everything. It is everything. And listening to people who have done exceptionally well in their lives, it's amazing to hear the origin stories and to hear the length that they've gone to and the things that they've done to make it work. And I find that lights an enormous fire in my belly, and hard work has never scared me off. I have a high appetite for that. I love it. And it's just, if you said you could have someone work with someone of average intelligence, but they were at the 99th percentile for hard work, or someone at the 99th percentile for intelligence but average hard work, give me a team of those who are in the top 1% for hard work but average intelligence. We will move mountains. But the hard work is the crucial thing, right? I think that intelligence, it's a threshold of intelligence. When you think about it, right, how many people do you know or have you worked with that were no good at their job because they weren't smart enough? It's basically zero, right? Like people don't lose their jobs or are not good at it because they're not bright enough. There's 1,000 reasons why someone may not be great at their job. It's not because they're not clever enough. There's a lot of other things there that are so much more important in my view. And that was a lesson for me along the way. So yeah, I think, you know, social media is a highlight reel. It's a bragging medium, right? And look, I'm off Facebook and Instagram and all those things there, because for that reason. And look, I'll tell you a really quick story, and you can edit it out now later if you want to, right? So I'm on Strava to record my running and thing, but I've unfollowed everyone, right? Because I'm not interested in what they're doing. All I want to do is do it for myself. But anyway, one time I logged on and there were all these amazing photos of, you know, there was this beautiful pool and a sunset and things. And I was like, oh, wow, that person's life is fantastic. Gee, who's that? That was my first thought. And then I realized that they were photos I'd taken on my rides, and Strava had changed the algorithm to suddenly show them in the background. And I went, I know my life isn't that interesting. I live a very small life. I'm not extravagant. I don't go to plush places. They just happened to be the local Unley pool I'd been to, or the Glenelg when I'd taken a photo. And I realized then that I'd fooled myself without trying and with no intention into thinking how amazing my life or our life was. And then I thought, I've been able to do that with zero effort. They were incidental photos that only I was ever going to see. Imagine if someone was trying to show off. Imagine if someone was making an effort to cultivate an existence and a presence that looked impressive. I've just fooled myself into thinking my bland and boring life is amazing. What about those who are trying to do it? And that was a really big tipping point for me about what a load of rubbish social media is and how it's just really bad for you, I think, you know. So, like, you know, I'm quite Spartan with it, but my phone, I can't access emails, internet, nothing. I can call, text, listen to music, and I'm so much happier for it. So social media is just, it's a cesspool, you know, or it's people trying to present themselves as being something they're not. I think it's really bad for us, to be honest, but that's my personal view. And I practice what I preach. I'm off it all, but yeah, look, when I fooled myself into thinking this life is amazing and going, they're my photos, and I know my life's not that interesting, it made me realize that for those who are trying to present an image, it's not good. Comparison is the thief of all joy, Jesse. Comparison 100%. Is the thief of all joy.
Well, I think we've had a few conversations about that. Mate, just a quick one, just to go back to the practice journey for a sec.
Sure.
You start off with two chairs, you're now eight. What were the steps in between?
Sure. So we've built in increments of two is what we've found. So every time we've gone up, so going from an odd to an even number, our systems have held up. But every time we've gone from an even number to an odd number, we've had to redo everything. So
that's interesting.
Going from three to four was okay, but four to five was a big tipping point. Five to six was okay, but six to seven was having to redesign our workflow and our operations and things. That's what we've found. So we've kind of found in increments of two is where we hit that limit. My role, as you're very well aware, Jesse, has changed in the practice, where I bought it with a view to be a dentist.
Yep.
And I enjoyed that. But what I really love is the business, and that's what ticks my gears. So I find it fascinating. I just think it's such an interesting thing, and growing something, again, hard, interesting, meaningful. I'm a serviceable dentist. I'm not a bad dentist, but I'm not a superstar either. And I realized that I wanted to be as good as I possibly could and just to really excel. And I realized it was going to be a bit of a challenge to be the very best technical dentist in Adelaide. Mm. But I thought I could have a crack at having the best practice in Adelaide.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something for me that I remember sitting in Fitzroy Gardens in Melbourne reading Good to Great.
Jim Collins, yeah.
Yeah, on one of those getaways we're talking about just before, actually. And it dawned on me that, hey, I've got a crack at this. Like, I'm not going to be the best technical dentist in Adelaide, but I reckon I can have a real shot at having the best dental practice by the metrics that I define that as being. So we've got the three things are to be do really good dental care.
Mm-hmm.
Find a five-star patient experience and be an employer of choice. So they're the three things. They're the pillars upon which I judge who is or how we are going as being the best dental practice in Adelaide. Others will measure it differently. That's okay too, but they're the three things I look at there. But I was on the tools, seeing patients, all good. But as we grew, I was spending more and more time on the weekends and at work. And honestly, I loved it. It was quiet. It was just me, no patients, no staff. I could get into the deep work. But it was at the expense of family life.
Yeah.
And then over Easter weekend 2019, I guess, 2020, 20, Sorry, I'm not sure. Anyway, a couple of years ago, and I spoke to you, Jesse, and you were very helpful, but I realized having Good Friday at home, one day with my daughter, then Saturday at home, 2 days, and then 3 days, and then 4 days. And each day she warmed me that bit more. And I said to my wife, I said, look, it's like she's a different girl. And I said, but she's not, I am. It's because I'm home for four consecutive days here that she is growing her in her affection for me. Mm. And I said, something's got to change. And I had gone from five or four clinical days to three to two. And then
I remember this,
had a chat with you. And, you quite wisely said, Michael, after two, it's zero, not one. And you're right. So I went and spoke to my senior team the very next day after I realized with my wife, hey, this isn't working. And I said, I've got to, I'm going to go off the tools. We need to put a plan in place now for that to happen. So I had some very clever people, some people who are invested in mine and the practice's success to help map that out and how we went about that. And a lot of dentists, what they think or feel that they are absolutely integral, that their patients will never see someone else. And I kind of call BS on that because I was the linchpin for the practice, right? I've got stacks of very, very positive Google reviews from my patients. They really liked me. One thing I can do, there's lots of people who can drill and feel better than me, but I know how to build a practice. I know how to build a patient base. You're no more popular with your patients than I was. Mm-hmm. And I say that as a positive in the sense that you can do it. It's not to sit here and grandstand. It's actually to go, look, if I can do it, you can do it too, in terms of having your patients stick around. I don't think we might have lost a couple, but it was, and even those that traveled, which was really fascinating, those that traveled a long way from the country still kept coming along. So my message is to those who go, do you know what? I'd love to scale. I'd love to go a bit more off the tools. My message is it can be done. I've done it. I know it can be done. So have heart from that, like you really should be utterly convinced that it is possible there, and to have an enormous amount of hope from that this is doable.
I also remember the conversation. I remember the conversation we had was at the Gold Coast, mm-hmm. and I think it was at Longboard's Bar, if I'm not mistaken.
Sounds familiar.
And probably over a beer or something similar.
That sounds familiar too.
And I remember the conversation we had was about running an experiment.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I do. So can I go? Yeah. So go, Jesse, ahead. You very wisely said, you said, you talked to me about there being, one-way doors and two-way doors. Mm. And you said, Michael, why don't you do it for a period and get proof of concept, see how it goes. You can always go back to it. If it doesn't work or you don't like being off the tools, you can go back to it. And that dawned on me as well about, you're right. And that was the first instance that preceded going off the tools completely, was that instance of ruling off a month to 6 weeks in 6 months' time. So I had patients booked in and we did it. So I think for the month of February 2022 or thereabouts, I got home and said to my team, I'm not seeing anyone. We're gonna test this out. And thanks to you and thanks to our conversation. So that was very, very helpful to get that proof of concept, which I think then helped when I ended up saying 6 months later, hey, I need to go from two to zero now, knowing that it worked, knowing that I didn't miss the drilling and filling, and also knowing that I could go back to it if I wanted, was all very helpful in terms of, getting proof of concept in my head and being clear on the path forward, being clear on the practical elements of it, and being clear on the likely success of it as well.
So I want to ask you a question about this, mate, because there'll be listeners here thinking, how do I join these dots if I'm thinking about doing this myself? There's obviously a couple of lessons in amongst all this. And so I want to just ask the question up front and early is, when you went to 0 days, at that point, how many chairs did you have? And how important was that leverage that you had to make sure your income didn't kind of nosedive? And equally, before you went from two to zero, what proportion of revenue were you personally generating? Because I know we've spoken about measuring your contribution, all that sort of stuff.
So we're at six chairs when I decided to go to zero.
Yeah.
So we're at six chairs. And so I track very closely the proportion of revenue that each clinician builds over the previous 12 months. So mine was somewhere between 12 and 16%.
So you'd whittled that down over the years,
right? Yeah. So it was at 54 at its highest. And then each year I could track it, 54, 44, 32, 22, 12, and then could make so in successive years. So it was not done on a wing and a prayer. It was, I think my spirit animal is a boa constrictor, right? I just squeezed the risk out of everything. So like I knew, you know, it's really unglamorous. People like tigers because they chew stuff up and blood and gore and stuff. The boa constrictor will just quietly suffocate you, right? And I think that's what I do with problems. I just quietly suffocate the life and the risk out of it. So I knew my numbers within so very well that it got to a point where I realized that my business profit far exceeded my profit as a business income, far exceeded my income as a clinician.
Yeah.
By a scale of a lot to not much. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, again, the risk on that, therefore, is really low because worst case scenario, 100%. You're going to lose your clinical income. But
correct.
Then you can replace that by, you know, adding extra chairs, having more productive associates and so on and so forth, right? So I want to ask you a little bit about the stages of 2 chairs to 4 chairs to 6 to 8. What systems broke first? What were the things that broke down? Was it team structures and roles and clarity? Did you have to go from corridor conversations to more formal communication systems? What was happening on the floor?
Look, I think it's a really good question, and it's something of a cop out to say everything, but I think that our reception set up for starters. I think how to handle that patient flow. So I looked at things with high customer flow. So I looked at McDonald's, I looked at airports, and looked at reception is a big one, to be honest. Like that's kind of the heartbeat of the practice, right? So looking at that, having the patient throughput for a 2-chair, 4-chair, 6-chair, now 8-chair practice looks very, very different. So I looked at, as I said, places with a high throughput of customers, so airports and McDonald's. And what I figured out was, I was like, how do they overcome this problem? Looking outside of industry. And the difference is when I look at the key things that reception does, you know, make appointments, so take payments, make appointments, check patients in, check them out. And there's one other, I can't think what it is. But what I realized was, well, how do other places do that? And the key difference is that those high throughput places, like an airport, like McDonald's, they don't take phone calls. That's the thing. So you can't call up the front desk of Jetstar. You can't call up a McDonald's very easily. So that's the unpredictable nature. That's the variable that's hardest to get a gauge on. So we did things like trying to move some of our, and we haven't quite optimized it, but have a center to take the phone calls outside of that to also differentiate the reception from just being, these are our reception team for the day, to go, do you know what? And this is not my idea. One of my team members had this idea, which is a very good one, is each reception, we've got 3 or 4 reception stations, and each of them has specific accountability checklists for that day. So you're not just on reception, you're in reception 1 or reception 2 or reception 3 or reception 4. And they have specific tasks that is their responsibility on that day. So not everyone is doing all the same thing. So to divide it up, Jesse, that was very helpful, to divide up the workflow as we've grown.
What that gives you then is having one person accountable for reception 1, one person accountable for reception 2. Because the lesson here, ladies and gents, is if 2 people are accountable, no one's accountable, right?
Yeah.
And so reception 1 now has very clear responsibilities, and same with reception 2, 3, 4. And I really like that, because traditionally what people do is here's the end of day task for reception. Mary says, I thought Susie did that. Susie says, exactly. I thought Jane did it. And it's a schmozzle. So I really love that. That's a really good key lesson, guys. So write that down. Thank you, Michael. That's a really good thing. Can we talk about communication for a second? Because, you know, the expression that I like is going from a band of pirates to a navy. You know, when you're in a small practice, you can manage by conversations in the corridor. It's very informal. It's got a different vibe to a larger practice. And when you get larger, you have to become more disciplined, right? And that discipline is really, really important. So how has your practice had to become more disciplined, whether it be communications or anything else?
So it's a really good question. And I love that too, that, yeah, when you're small, you can be nimble and just everyone does a bit of everything. And I think also when you're a small practice, you need people who are very good generalists. So you've got to have a nurse who can do a bit of reception and a bit of this and a bit of stereo and a bit of that and likewise. Whereas as we've grown, we now are at a point where we can hire specialists for that. So we've got the person who can do better at each. On the point of communication, Jesse, you're right, then we've had to have more structure to that. And we've changed that as we've gone as well. So we would have Monday morning management meetings where the senior team would meet to discuss things and run through things. Then we realized we weren't bringing the team along with us as much as what we could. So we've tweaked that further to bring up the next level and involve them in that discussion. So I think that we use Slack, which is quite helpful. So in terms of the day-to-day at a practice of our side to be able to communicate with each other. But we definitely need, and we've got the feedback we get from clinicians who work at Fullerton Park Dental is that it's the best run practice they've worked at. So we have very good people in management and operational roles who are very good at their jobs. And that helps enormously in terms of being able to ensure things are running smoothly and not just run around like headless chooks. So we do operate like the Navy. We're very clear on expectations. To come back to the point, Jesse, about if everyone's responsible, or if two people are responsible, no one's responsible, there's an accountability checklist we have each day as well for each station. So not only are they clear on what it is, the expectations, but they're held accountable for doing that. And we've also realized as we've grown, we need to find people who want to work in the Navy, not on a pirate ship, who like structure, who like clear ways of doing things. So we now have a strong cohort of people that like that structure, that don't just want to fly by the seat of their pants. I heard another podcast that talked about athletes, when they go to the media, they want to be held accountable because they always are used to being, what was my time for that lap? How many possessions did I get? How many kicks did I get? They're very used to being on the clock and being held accountable. And my view is, I think high performers want to be held accountable. I want to be held accountable. My team members want to be held accountable. And that's not to say we don't have fun, because of course we do, but we just like to be clear on who does what and why and get stuff done. So we are now, the people who don't want to be held accountable. My question is why? Like, what part of it? I think being clear on expectations has been a massive learning point for me, Jesse. So when I first started out as an associate, I had a nurse I worked with who was lovely, but I wasn't clear on what my expectations are of her, and it didn't work out. It wasn't great. So that taught me a very important lesson that nowadays, instead of changing the rules as we go along, right, on purpose or inadvertently, now it's an opt-in. So when I interview people, I show them our golden rules for each role, which everyone listening should have. And I say, this is what we believe in. If you're on board for this, great. We'd love to have you. If not, that is okay too, but I can't employ you. So we seek from our team members to say, this is what we do. We define the rules of the playground. It's up to you whether you want to play in it or not. But it stops there being a push and pull back and forth. We are really clear on the expectation. Then it's up to others to either jump on board or withdraw their labour. And either way, that's okay, but you can't be on the fence.
Yeah, I love that. You're either, it's a hell yeah or a no, right?
And 100%. Derek Sivers, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. So one of the things, coming back to that nurse, right, that you said didn't end well, and again, I don't want to put words in your mouth or anything of that nature. I think one of my experiences in life is that I've never yet met a team member who goes to work deliberately wanting to do a bad job, right? That I just haven't met that person. I'm sure they exist somewhere and whatever. But my contention is that when things don't work out, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes it is because we've not set them up properly in the first instance, right? And that's our problem, not their problem, right?
Agree.
And so sometimes, I guess for the listeners here, if you've got a team member who's not working out for you or you're a bit frustrated with, the question I'd be asking yourself is, have I set them up? Have I been clear with my expectations? Is there some sort of miscommunication about they think they're doing a great job, but I'm not, not seeing it the same way? And so I'd encourage everyone to go back on that and have a look. Mate, what I want to talk about though is the transition from pirate to Navy, okay?
Sure.
Because there is you don't kind of become a Navy overnight, right? There's probably some people in the early stages who kind of like the pirate ship, and it's yeehaw, it's great fun. I'm trying to think of a sea shanty to go to, but I can't off the top of my hat. But I guess the question I want to ask you is, was everyone originally on board, or did you have to have this expression of what got you here won't get you there and who got you here won't get you there? Was there some attrition along the way?
Yeah, look, I think so. Yeah, so I think initially there were a couple of team members who were nice people, but they weren't – I think I was really clear in my vision, and I made that very clear, and I can be accused of a lot of things, I suppose, but lacking clarity is not one of them. Everyone knows – what I'm after, what I'm interested in, where they stand with me. So that's certainly helpful and powerful, I suppose. So, but absolutely right. We operate a certain way, and we talk about the Fullerton Park Dental way, and you do have to change it. It's not everyone's cup of tea. Some people want to not operate in an environment like that, and that's okay too. I respect that, you know, and not everyone wants to operate in a big practice too. You know, they want that, you know, a bit more, yeah, they're having only a dentist and a hygienist and a receptionist and a nurse and that's it more or less. And just kind of, for the most part, people have come along for the ride and come along for the journey, which is good. Like they haven't, I'm just trying to think now, but there's definitely changes there. But I think that I was lucky to have some core people initially who were on board and then to surround myself with more of them. So we've gone from sort of, you know, 5-6 team members to 28 now. Yeah. And I think it's about finding the right people and finding people who are similarly inclined, where we talk about singing from the same hymn sheet.
Yeah, 100%. And one of the things you spoke about was, you know, one of your strengths is being clear and communicating that. And I think that it actually is a really important superpower that you do have. What I wanted to ask you about around that was, how do you communicate your vision? Is it because, you know, Michael's always saying the same things? Is it documented? How do you bring that vision to life? I'm probably a bit the same because I'm pretty clear with these things. I figure I've said it about enough times when people start either rolling their eyes or repeating the words that I'm about to say, right?
Totally.
I think that's true.
And you know, like I waffle on a bit, no question. So there's a bit of that. And there's definitely the repetition of Michael, I get it. But I think for me, Jesse, this idea of leadership, right? And just quickly on how we operate, you know, culture, people talk about culture is behavior. If you behave well, you've got a good culture. If people behave poorly, they've got a bad culture, right? So for me, this idea of leadership and going, oh, well, what does that look like? And, oh, I've never been really much of a natural leader. I'm more of a lone wolf, just doing my own thing and minding my own business. And how does that look? So for me, the only way I could kind of authentically do that is to be really clear and be myself, but be the best version of myself, but to demonstrate the behaviors that I wanted to see in others and that I wanted others to do in terms of putting the patient first, in terms of hard work. And so that then, to lead by example, I suppose, through my actions there. So I'm a writer, as you know, I like to write. So we have an intranet, which everything is made really clear. So that's the first. And what I found is, like you said, people want to come to work to do a good job. So if you can set the goalposts really clear, it makes their life easier and they're grateful. They go, oh, I really like this because I come on board and I feel like I know what's expected of me at the practice from the start. So that's been really good. So I write it all down. I document it, write to as clear as can be. So we've got very clear systems and frameworks on these things, but we also make the point, you be you. We want you because you're you. This isn't a script. This is a template. So, you know, you're allowed, we've got you here because we want you to work within these guidelines and these templates, and they're there to help you, not to constrain you, but you can let your personality come through. You don't want to go completely off track, of course, but people get that. People like systems and they like clear paths forward and what's expected of them. But we also encourage people to say, you know, like, you're allowed to be you. We don't want a robot. You're allowed to talk with your patients and be yourself. But here's our overarching framework there, rather than saying, in this exact situation, say this, in this exact situation, say that. And we find that we get a high level of engagement with that because people like structure, right? I feel that inherently people like to know what's expected of them, you know? So changing the goalposts doesn't work. So they like the structure and they want the autonomy as well to go, I'm really clear in the structure. I'm glad of that, but I can go about and do my job each day and not have someone say, oh, you said and when you should have said but, or but instead of and, or something like that.
So we would talk about freestyling within a framework or autonomy with guardrails or whatever language you want to put to it, right? So, mate, one of the things I want to come to now, though, is you've successfully extracted yourself from clinical dentistry, and I think that's a really good achievement for those that want to do that. And, of course, whether people want to go down to 0 days or just have the right number of days, there's no one right answer for any of this, right? So it's about optimizing your practice for the things that you like. Now, for some people, it's 5 days a week clinically and having all the admin taken off their plate. Others, it's, in your case, at the other end of the spectrum, it's 0 days. And for a lot of people, there's an in-between amount, right?
Sure.
What I want to ask you about now is this conception, I believe misconception, of the absentee practice owner, because you're not an absent practice owner.
No.
You're just not on the tools clinically, but you're very much a present practice owner. And what I want to talk about there is, what does your day look like now, and what freedoms has this afforded you to not be on the tools clinically?
It's a really good point. So I'm not a believer in the passive income practice.
Me neither.
In the sense, I think.
And I think actually if you're trying to set that up from the outset, I think you're doomed.
Agreed. And I've had this conversation with my senior team about, look, in theory, the practice should work the same whether I'm here or not. But I said, what is it that when I'm there that seems to be different? And you know, I'm not trying to overstate my importance, but the feedback is, look, the place just hums that little bit different when the boss is there. And I get that. But in terms of what it's freed me up to do, look, I probably haven't made the most of freeing up the time, because I love what I do. So I'm heavily engaged with it.
Yeah.
But what that has, and I could exploit that a bit, not exploit, I could use that a bit more, to be honest. But what it's freed me up to do is to actually just get to work on the things that I really want to work on. So that's been the biggest currency for me, has been that I get to go to work each day and work on those hard, interesting, meaningful tasks that most interest me. So for me, they're not clinical tasks. They're growing the business and what does that look like and all the strategy and where are we heading and all those sorts of things there. So the freedom it's allowed me, I think definitely it does allow more freedom in terms of, you know, if something comes up, I can go to my daughter's athletics carnival or something like that, which is great. But I haven't maximized that potentiality, I suppose, because I'm fortunate that I have the other freedom, which is to be able to work on the stuff I want to work on. So for me, that's what it's allowed. But if someone, I'm a very big believer, I don't think the absentee practice works. I think you've got to be there. I think it's really important to be there. I think, yeah, it's something that's, yeah, I'm certainly still here 4 days a week in my office like I am now, and I'm working, and my team see that. And I can also, I have set time. So what does my day look like? So I have clinician meetings once every week or two with each clinician. I have meetings with my senior team to help them. There's also the ad hoc stuff that comes up. Occasional clinical cases, if someone wants me to jump in and have a look, I'm happy to do that too. But then also I sit down at the start of each day and I write down everything I need to do, every task. And then I go, okay, there's my list. And then I go, right, I put an asterisk next to the ones that will, you know, move the needle the most. And then I do that. And then I go, right, the ones that have the asterisks, rank them. And then I start with number one and I do that. And then I do number two and I do that. And honestly, Jesse, if I get my number one task done each day, it's a win, because that's the most important thing that will get me furthest, fastest. So some of those things linger on that list for a long time, but I just sit there with a pen and paper, no internet, no nothing, and just start writing, and then prioritize and be really clear then to get back to priority. What is the number one priority? And, you know, it's the big, hairy, ugly frog. It's the thing you don't want to do, but you must do to take you further. The idea of clearing the decks, I'll do everything else so I can get to the big stuff tomorrow. It doesn't work, because tomorrow there's more stuff to fills it up. So you just got to do, I don't deal with things as they come in. I deal with things, I'm very disciplined around that too, of doing the, you know, eating the frog and getting on with it.
So a couple of things, a big lesson here, and I really like, I want to just hang on this point for a second, because I think there's a distinction here that I'd really like the audience to get, is most people will look at their to-do list and they might rank them in order of importance in their mind. But what I really like what you've done is that next layer, and this is something that we've got five numbers that run our business, which I won't bore you with, but in our business, I always say, if we're not doing something that's moving in those five numbers, why are we doing it, right? What's the point? And so what I love that you've thought about is, of these activities on my to-do list, which one moves the needle?
Yeah.
Firstly, first question, which moves the needle? And then I'll triage those ones and prioritize those from there. And everything else is kind of, you know, the pebbles in the sand in the proverbial beaker jar, right? And so I really love that. So ladies and gents, I think that's some gold that Michael shared with you. And I'd really encourage you to think about what are the activities that move the needle in your practice, and making sure you're focusing expressly on getting those things done first and foremost. Michael, I know I could talk to you for days on this, and we often do, but what have been some of the lessons you've learned along the way? Because we either have wins or lessons, or actually we have wins, losses, and lessons, and we can choose whether we turn losses into lessons. So I prefer to think about lessons. But what have been the lessons that you've taken away from this journey? What are the things you've learned that have been really important for yourself, for the business, or just in general? And equally, if you were passing on some thoughts or some, I don't like the word tips because I don't want it to sound like the seven hacks to getting off the tools or anything silly like that, because this is a deep thought, you know, process here. What would be your advice or insights or things you'd share with the audience if they were thinking about the same journey?
Find the people who jive on the same wavelength as what you do, okay? Mm. Like, we've all had team members where it feels like an arm wrestle every day. And they're trying to convince you to do change your ways and you're trying to convince them and it doesn't work. So I've frankly kind of given up on that. Mm. And I want to work with people that I want to work with. And I want people that I feel like I'm working with, not against. You know, it's the thing, I think the guy from Southwest Airways, is it? In Herb Keller, is that right? I'm trying to recall, Jesse.
I can't remember the name, I'm sorry.
I forgot. Anyway, he talked about the fact, he said, look, if you wake up 3 mornings in a row thinking of the same woman and it's not your wife, you need to get rid of that person, as in a team member. And I think that's true, you know, like if someone is on my mind or and I think it's the same way. If you wake up thinking about your boss, if you're an employee several times in a row, you need to look for a different position because it's just not working out. So for me, I think we have so tips and tricks, I guess, although there are no hacks, you've got to do the work. But I think find your crew, find the people who want what you want.
Yeah.
Super important. Accountability, hold yourself accountable, hold others accountable, and find people who are up for that and want that and be really clear on that there. There's an enormous joy in working with like-minded people. I just think that's so nourishing, so fulfilling. So I think work hard for that and push hard for it. You know, there's a, you know, say the thing you cannot say, whatever that might be. If you've got a team member who's not working the way you want them to be, say the thing you think you cannot say. And sometimes it's actually telling the person who you probably should be telling how well they're doing that you haven't done for a while is sit them down and tell them that too, you know, let them know that. So I think, yeah, find the right team, find the right people and be really unwavering in that, you know, have a vision, be the type of person that people want to work for and work with too. You know, you can't be a, you know, negative Nelly. You've got to have something that is attractive to people. Find those people who want to be around you, hold yourself and others accountable. And, yeah, enjoy what comes.
I love that. Okay, mate, one last question with that notice, sorry. What's the future hold for Fullerton Park Dental and for you personally?
That's a really good question. I think that we're growing quite quickly and we're scaling. So we're at 8 chairs, we've got capacity for 10, but then we look at all sorts of things. So we look at differentiating our service offerings, do we look at extended hours, extended days, all those sorts of things there. So that's a where heading. I think that, you know, I sat down pen and paper and looked at, you know, what is the very, very biggest we can be? How does that look? And then you go, right, well, that's your goal. And not just biggest for the sake of being biggest, but if all our systems held up and everything worked in terms of, you know, hours and usability of the practice and the premises and the capital that's there, what does that look like? So that becomes the goal. We start to work towards that. Beyond that, honestly, Jesse, I don't really know. I'm not really a guy who's interested in having multi-sites. No. It just, I haven't seen it done well. But like I said, that hard, interesting, meaningful, it's hard. I'm not passionate about oral health for it to be meaningful in the sense of feeling like I've got to change everyone's oral hygiene habits. But it's not interesting to me. It doesn't light a fire in me to have 37 different practices. So to me, I don't quite know what that looks like. I'm 40, so, you know, I think I've got a fair bit of working life left in me. Exactly what that looks like, I don't know. But for Fullerton Park Dental specifically, keep doing what we're doing. Keep on that track. I think now, honestly, it's about executing. We've got the plans. We know what we're doing. We know what we're trying to achieve. We don't need to spend an enormous amount of time in think tank sessions. We've got to execute on our vision, execute on our plans. That's where we're at.
I just want to mention that you've opened up a really interesting train of thought, and I'm probably opening up a whole new conversational loop.
Go for it.
Efficient use of capital. You just mentioned that. And I just can't let the conversation go without kind of just going, hang on, got to hold up before we wrap this. Because this is one of my biggest things. I'm always talking to our clients, and you know, you've heard me say this many, many times, that you know, the purpose of an asset is to turn it into revenue into profit into cash flow. And then with cash flow, you can do 3 things. You can either reduce debt, pay the owner, or reinvest into the business and have more assets, right? So, and the process of taking an asset and turning it into cash flow is a measure of business efficiency. So I'm loving this concept of squeezing the orange, right? So tell me how you squeeze the orange in Fulton Park.
Look, I think, and you're bang on, and that resonates with me, what you've said. And you've got the four assets, which is your physical assets, you've got your goodwill, your HR, and then your IP. And everyone worries about the first three and forgets about the fourth one, but that's another story.
Look
just at the first one of the physical assets of the practice there. You sit down and you go, it's 168 hours in a week, 7 times 24, of course, and looking at our opening hours and going, gee, we're only open for, I think it was 23% of the available hours in a week. And going, if I had an asset that was only working for me one-fifth of the available time, that's a lazy asset, right?
Yeah.
And then you go, well, how can we get more out of that? So then you look at your – so there's fixed costs and variable costs, and you go, you might as well – you've got to pay your fixed costs either way. You've got to escape gravity by ensuring that you're maximizing everything else. So in terms of, squeezing the juice out of the lemon or the orange and efficient use of capital. It's going, if the chair's going to be there anyway, I might as well have it operational for as many hours in the day as you can. So sitting there going, how do I open that up there? So in terms of extended hours each day or extended opening hours, and kind of looking at where that taps out in terms of asking people to come at 3 a.m. in the morning for a dental appointment, it's probably a bit of a stretch, but there's a lot more possibilities, a lot more lemon left in the juice left in the lemon to extract and be efficient with the use of that capital that sits there idle 4 days out of five.
Yeah, 100%. And knowing where the point of diminishing returns is
100%.
In there as well, right?
So, yeah.
Exactly. Thank you for indulging me on that, mate, because I think it's a really important topic, and it's one that gets my juices going. Michael, you've been really generous with your time today, mate. Lots of really good lessons here. I'm really pleased to see the success that you've had, mate, and you've worked very, very hard. And you are the walking example of doing what it takes rather than doing your best. And I really admire that ethic of rolling your sleeves up, gritting your teeth, and just getting the job done. And you know what? The beauty of that, and I think, again, I just want to point this out, is that's not a forever proposition. You're not in the ceiling space cleaning out walnuts forever, but the rewards far outweigh the work. And I just want to acknowledge the work you've put in and celebrate the rewards you're now reaping, mate. So great job.
Thank you very much, Jesse. Thanks for your help along the journey too. That's certainly been, we've sort of just gently touched on a few of those, but no, you've very much been a strong mentor and supporter and help to me. So really appreciate your help too, mate.
Oh, mate, you're very welcome, and you've always been a good friend. So I appreciate that. All right, mate. Well, we'll let you get back to your day, but thanks once again for taking the time, and let's catch up for another beer at Longboards.
Sounds good. Thank you, Jesse.
Thanks, Michael. Cheers, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.